John Oldale's book, A World of Curiosities, surprising, interesting, and downright unbelievable facts from every nation on the planet, is exactly that. The countries are arranged alphabetically, and the amount of space allotted each varies from a single page to four or five, but each entry will have you laughing or shaking your head or going to Google for confirmation. It's the kind of book that you can open anywhere and find something intriguing, good for subway rides, latte lines, or while you're waiting for a pedicure to dry. Pithier than the Encyclopedia Britannica, more erudite than Ripley's Believe It or Not, and culturally richer than the Guinness Book of World Records, this is a book that earns its place in every waiting room or bathroom library. It's published by Plume, and I'm very pleased that it has brought John Oldale to our show today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with a few examples. Under Bosnia, you described the circumstances of the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Didn't I learn everything about that in my high school history class? That was the incident, I was told, that sparked World War One.
Well, that's absolutely true. I guess there was a little bit more detail that might have been left out in the history lessons. So what actually happened was a bunch of people, the Black Hand Gang, who wanted to kill the Archduke for their own political purposes. But they had free shots at it, which is perhaps not known. So the first guy positioned himself in the crowd as the Archduke, who was in Sarajevo, came past. He didn't fire his gun because he probably was just too scared, but he says there's a policeman behind him. The second guy did actually have a go at him, but by some sort of fluke, the hand grenade which he tossed bounced off the Archduke's arm and went off somewhere else. Now, one would have thought that the Archduke would have got the message and scooted off pretty fast, but he didn't. He carried on, although he did decide to change the route. But the driver obviously got lost or something. Didn't quite get across, and found himself stuck in a back alley, at which point assassin number three, who'd given up for the day, making off and thinking that he'd better just make himself scarce, had gone off to a sandwich shop to have a break for lunch. He looked out the window, saw the Archduke right in front of him, jumped out, fired off two rounds, and the rest, as they say, is history. So, yes.
So if Bosnian delis provided home delivery, we might have had to wait perhaps years for another excuse to start World War One.
Yeah, absolutely. It's strange to think about those little sort of quirky facts that change the course of history. Yes.
And you note that Europe's loss was wildlife game.
Yes. The Archduke happened to be a somewhat fanatical hunter, and he had 300,000 various trophies on his walls, so quite possibly Europe would have been devoid of wildlife if he'd been left to carry on. So yes,
let's talk about some other things. Where does the word assassin come from?
The assassins were like a very ahead of the game. There were a bunch of Iranians who set themselves up in the wilds in the sort of thing about the 11th century. Had this castle, and basically they were like hitmen for hire, and they were the best of the best. They called themselves the assassins because they chewed on hashish. Obviously, I don't think they did this one on a job because it might have affected the results. But anyway, they would descend from their mountains into the plains and kill people.
So assassin and hashish come from the same root.
Exactly, yes. Assassin comes straight from hashish.
Now, you include an interesting letter from Tito to Stalin about assassins.
Yes. When Tito broke with the Soviet Union, Stalin sent various people to try and finish him off, to no great effect.
The same sort of thing he'd done to Trotsky earlier.
Exactly. And so Tito didn't think much of this at all. And he sent this short letter, which was actually found with Stalin when he died, which basically said, "Please stop sending me assassins. If you carry on, I'll have to send one of my own, and I won't need any more." So it seemed to do the trick, because obviously, Tito lived a long, happy life.
You reveal that the first person historically recorded to have mooned his enemy.
Yes, I don't think his actual identity is known, but he was some nameless Roman soldier who was obviously bored on shift guarding the temple in Jerusalem, who just sort of lifted his tunic skirt, showed his buttocks to the crowd, and sparked a riot which ended up in a lot of Jerusalem, including the temple, being trashed and burnt to the ground. So, yes, it didn't go down very well.
In reading about Hungary, I learned that it's probably the most difficult language in the world.
Hungarian. It's certainly an extremely difficult language to learn, largely because it doesn't have any obvious links to the other European languages, which makes it very, very tricky.
Does anybody know why this language developed? As I understand it, it has some links to perhaps Scandinavian languages.
Well, the only other European language is Finnish and Estonian, I think they all came effectively from somewhere out in Siberia. So these tribes migrated through settled. One branch went south to Hungary, one branch went north to Scandinavia, and they don't have any links. But I would actually take you up, because I do elsewhere say that I think it's in Botswana, they have the toughest language in the world, because has 75, I think it is, different sorts of click, which is very difficult for... Exactly, yes.
Osa.
Well, that's one of them, for sure, and a whole load of others. You see it written with the exclamation marks and the question marks and what have you.
But still, Hungarian has 18 cases, 72 verb forms, and rhymes are important.
quite possibly. I have to say that the detail of that one escapes me.
Well, there was you have to end certain verb conjugations with rhymes that with sounds that rhyme with the beginning of the word.
Right. Well.
You told me that.
Yes, no, that's right. And I'm just thinking that a traveling Hungarian would obviously do very well in court in Somalia, because you'll see that in Somalia you have to litigate in poetry. So they would obviously be ahead of the game there.
Yeah. Now, is there any connection, you think, between the irregularities of the Hungarian language and the prominence of mathematicians or the number of Nobel Prizes awarded to Hungarians?
Yes, I think there probably is. I mean, the Hungarians have done exceptionally well in mathematics, and in particular, most people will be familiar with the Rubik's Cube, which is a Hungarian invention. And I think probably it's very good brain training.
And then there was Paul Erdős, who seems to have something in common with Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, well, Paul Erdős is definitely somebody who would probably be a stereotypical mathematician. I mean, he referred to God as the supreme fascist, which is perhaps a very draconian way of referring to somebody, and he spent his whole life sleeping on people's floors. But he managed, in between all that, to produce more mathematical papers than anybody in history. So, yes, he's obviously got the right brain.
My guess is John Oldale. He's written a book called A World of Curiosities. It is available from, now I'm forgetting the publisher.
Plume.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener calls in to point out that assassins were Persians, not realizing that Iranians are Persians.
That's right. I mean, your listener is correct in that for most of history they were called Persians, but yes.
And then another listener says Basque is a very difficult language.
Basque is indeed an extremely difficult language, perhaps even more isolated than Hungarian, in that people think that actually the Basques were probably the original inhabitants of Europe. Everybody else is an interloper who's come in from India or from Central Asia, and the Basques have been sitting in their mountain fastness in northern Spain and have just fighting their corner since then.
And so they have a language that has absolutely no Latin in it.
Absolutely no Latin in there. And I forget some of the details, but the words in Basque go right back to things like stone axes and such like things, suggesting that the Basque language was actually created way back in the early Iron Ages or even maybe the late Stone Ages, and has just sat there ever since.
So it's modern Cro-Magnon.
Yes, that's a nice way of putting it.
On a totally different topic, didn't Lebanon petition the EU to have the exclusive right to manufacture hummus? I was wondering about that because we have, you may not know this, but in Brooklyn on Atlantic Avenue, we have a number of stores that make their own hummus. And I was wondering if Lebanon had been successful, whether they would have to call it something else. And what about the pita chips?
I think if the Lebanese had been successful, I suspect that the stores in New York would be absolutely fine, because I think the Americans have a fine tradition of ignoring EU directives on everything under the sun. But
well, what was their argument? Is Lebanon the place where hummus was created, invented?
I think that's certainly with their argument. I believe that what the Lebanese and the Israelis do to bolster their claims is they take in turns to grab the world's largest hummus pot record. So they make ever larger pots. But, I mean, who can say when way back in history, I mean, Israel and Lebanon are effectively the same strip of land, whereabouts in that little piece of land the first person had an idea of sort of grinding up chickpeas.
But it would sound to me like there's a political aspect
to this. Of course, yes. There's no way that the Israelis or the Lebanese were going to give ground to the other side. So there's clearly an angle there. And I guess with the Jewish diaspora here, undoubtedly the Israeli version is much better known. But
well, you include a list of each country called intangible cultural heritage.
Mm-hmm.
What's that, and who decides it? And could you give us some examples?
People may be familiar with a system called the World Heritage Sites, which is basically a UN-sponsored global preservation umbrella, I guess. So the best of the best locations, like the Statue of Liberty, for example, have this extra protection, which is like a supranational protection. And I think a lot of particularly countries in the third world, African countries and so forth, where they maybe don't have so many big skyscrapers or great national canyons or whatever that's immediately obvious, felt that this wasn't quite a fair system, and that things like basket making or folk tales or instruments in West Africa, for example, gourd instruments, they're deserving, just as deserving as recognition.
And you also list the global heritage sites in the book for each country. Does every country have some site that is given that kind of credit?
No, not every country. The vast majority of countries do. I believe that the country of the most is Italy, which is perhaps not surprising. I mean, that's about 50-odd, and China has a lot as well.
But it's interesting that Argentina gets the tango. There are a lot of interesting things in Argentina, aren't there?
In terms of intangible global heritage, yes. I mean there's a whole meat-eating business, for example. I mean, the Argentines certainly eat more meat than anybody else, and they obviously do have physical things as well, but I think the tango is probably their most famous export.
Can you remember the first fact of this sort that ever came to your attention that got you intrigued in doing this sort of thing?
A personal experience was when I was probably about 14, 15, I was in the old Soviet Union. Russia, they didn't have much in those days. One of the standard drinks they made on the streets was something called kvass, which is a fermented bread liquid, which doesn't sound very appealing. I mean, it tastes better than it sounds. But I was struck by, that is really strange. How do people have fizzy bread, effectively. And I think that possibly...
Well, any starch will create an alcohol.
Yes. Well, it's only very mildly alcoholic. It's a very sort of weak alcohol. It's more drunk for refreshment. It's more like the medieval. I mean, in Europe, in the Middle Ages, people drank beer instead of water because it was safer. And the beer they drank was a lot weaker than the beer we drink today. Otherwise,
more like American beer than European beer.
Very light, yes. So it's more like that for drinking. But I think that opened my eyes to the variety of the stuff in the world.
And then you took a trip to Damascus when you were 18 years old. What led you to do that?
I was just sort of kicking around, and I think I had no idea how difficult these things would be, and I just wanted to go a long way and so set off with a friend. We bought a really old small car. I think it cost us 300 quid, which might be about $500. And we just sort of filled it up with petrol and off we went.
And did you have an epiphany on the road to Damascus?
Yes. There's a sort of, the first thing that happened was when we were leaving England, we actually got stopped by the police because we neglected to register the car in our own name. So it still belonged to some little old lady. So the police were firmly convinced that we were stealing the car and we were on the way to Dover to the continent. So when he wound down the guy tapped on the window and he wound down the window and said, "Where do you think you're going?" And we said, "Oh, we're going to Damascus." At which point, you know, we were both 17. So we nearly got hauled off to the local police station. We did manage to persuade them. We had the visas and things. I saw so much of the world, had so many adventures in that trip. I think ever after I was set on the traveling path.
So you've gone to most of the places you write about.
I've been to about 90 countries worldwide, including most of the major countries. There are a couple of holdouts I'd love to visit, but I've been to just about every part of the world. And in truth, a lot of the countries, I mean, for example, Africa has about 56 countries. the boundaries are very arbitrary because they're imposed by the European powers, and so culturally it's a bit more of an interesting mélange than that. So I would say I've experienced most of the different cultures in the world, which is perhaps another way of saying it.
Do certain ones draw you back again and again?
Some of the big global cultures are incredibly rich. I mean, India is a fascinating place. You could spend your whole lifetime exploring India.
Because there are so many different Indias, in effect.
Exactly. And an interplay of different Indias as well. I mean, there's the sort of original Dravidian culture in the south, the Mughal overlay in the north, and the way these play. And one of the things I really enjoy is, one of your listeners, as you said, mentioned Persia. So if you go far enough west towards Pakistan, India, you begin to see the strong Persian influence, which obviously then transfers through Afghanistan into Persia itself and then melds with the Arabic influence. And that way of that mixing of cultures is something which I very much enjoy from my travel.
You say that one of the first facts you wondered about as a schoolboy was who exactly were the Scythians. Now, yes. I had those kinds of thoughts when I was a kid. I would look them up in some second-rate encyclopedia that my parents had bought, and that would have been the end of it. But you've kind of made a career of this.
The sad thing is I still haven't really found out who the Scythians are. I mean, they're fascinating people, and they were clearly people not to be messed with because they used to go around scalping everybody and breathing fire and terrifying the Romans. But they haven't left much, which is perhaps what we're talking about, the global heritage. I mean, certain cultures, they were a nomadic people. They charged across the plains on their horses. They didn't build big cities.
Well, where are they in Europe? Is it that where Albania?
No, they were mainly came from sort of what's now Ukraine, and so they're on the steppes, which is in the far east of Europe, sort of near the Black Sea, southern Russia, that sort of place. Europe has been subject to loads and loads of sort of migratory waves of invaders coming from the east, certainly until sort of Middle Ages. I mean, coming with the Turks, were the last major people who sort of reached the gates of Vienna in the sort of 15th century, and ever since the Europeans have been pushing back. So the Scythians were one of the very first of those, and it was their sort of allies, I mean, the Huns and the Vandals and people like that, who actually did for the Romans in the end.
So this has followed the Indo-European invasions that populated Persia and Greece and Italy.
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite a lot later than the Indo-European sort of settlers, I mean, because they're the people who...
What would I have learned if I just looked them up in Wikipedia? Because you do credit Wikipedia as one of your sources, although I am assuming you had to vet everything because Wikipedia is often wrong.
Well, yes. I mean, I honestly don't know what you'd have found if you looked in Wikipedia on the Scythians, but I'm a huge fan of Wikipedia as a start point. I've always tried to go beyond Wikipedia in my research. I wouldn't just like to rely on it entirely. But I do think people are very unfair because, I mean, Wikipedia is a fantastic project. And I understand that if you're looking up some rock star
or talk show host, they have so many things wrong about my life and I don't correct them.
Well, okay. Yes. And also there's the problem of the Vandals who go on and say or politically motivated things or what have you.
Well, the Scythians have not the Vandals.
Yeah, exactly. The sort of things I was looking at, the sort of Scythians, shall we say, it's not the Vandals aren't we're stuck on Scythians and Vandals here, but the Vandals wouldn't go and destroy a Scythian entry because not enough people would read it. So you're down to getting the facts wrong. But actually, a lot of this stuff is sort of done by experts. So I haven't found many problems with it, and I know Nature did a life-like comparison with the Britannica, and found a similar sort of error rate. I mean, everybody makes mistakes for sure, and I did notice that Britannica has actually stopped doing its paper version very recently. I mean, in a sense, handing the field to the Wikipedias of this world.
Well, would you say that there are probably some errors in this book as well? You call it a very old-fashioned book.
Undoubtedly, there are errors. I haven't actually... in the writing, I had one person point out a mistake under Holland. I'd got the forename of a Nobel Prize-winning biologist wrong. I'd got his brother, who, funnily enough, also got a Nobel Prize, but for economics. That's the only one I've had pointed out to me. I am sure there are mistakes in there. I've tried very, very hard to avoid them, but inevitably there will be some in there.
My guess is John Oldale OLDALE, his book, A World of Curiosities, Surprising, Interesting, and Downright Unbelievable Facts from Every Nation on the Planet. So is every nation covered here?
Yes, absolutely every nation is in here. I mean, it's a bit of a sort of moot point how many countries there are in the world. And it's a bit of a moving target. So whilst I was writing this book, South Sudan was created in July 2011. So I have to quickly write an extra chapter on South Sudan. But there's around 200 odd countries.
What about some of the countries that are less well known, like São Tomé?
Yes, São Tomé is a particularly challenging country to write about because it has a vanishingly low public profile. For listeners who don't know where São Tomé is, it's a tiny little island off Central Africa, and I am told stunningly beautiful.
And what about a country like Benin? It's named after a great ancient culture, but as I understand it, the ancient culture was actually in Nigeria.
That's right. There's a lot of this sort of name swapping going on in Africa. So
in Europe too, Macedonia, for example.
That is a very hot potato. Yes, I wouldn't like to get into that one. Certainly not with a Greek or a Macedonian. But for example, Ghana is not where Ghana is. Mali was not exactly where Mali was. People grabbed. I mean, Zimbabwe is obviously taken from some of the Zimbabwean ruins. It is roughly the right sort of place in that instance. So people grabbed something to give their country a bit of instant culture. But the Beninese, certainly, they were, I mean, very respected, even by the European colonials who turned to just sort of blanket the place and ignore everybody. Respected force. They were, of course, the people who had the Amazon army who fought the French to a standstill for about 2-3 years before finally, you know, guns count and in the end. But,
in Benin, what's the festival known as Custom?
The Custom Festival was a fairly gruesome affair where basically the king would once a year invite anybody who was one of his subjects to come along and ask him a question, ask him a favor, or petition him for whatever. And often, to get an answer or to choose the right course of action, he would need to consult the spirits. And that meant, unfortunately, killing some hapless slave. You can imagine that there were a lot of questions on some occasions. So I think the record was about 4,000 slaves who were then... What had happened is they would be sacrificed. The priest would first... whisper in their ear the question. They would get their throats slit, which is very unfortunate for them, and then allegedly the answer would come back from the spirits a few minutes later, and the king would opine. It was actually that which was the end for the Beninese, because the French said, right, I'm sorry, you know, in the name of civilization, we can't do this, and they came in and took the place over.
You have a lot of interesting information about maps, and I'd never thought about this, mm-hmm. because every map I've ever seen has the North Pole at the north and the South Pole at the south. Mm-hmm. But there are many maps, even in the Northern Hemisphere, that are what I might call upside down.
Yes, or exactly upside down or on their side or whatever. So, for example, traditionally the Islamic maps would orient themselves so that they were facing to the south because the thinking was that the traveller would always look at the rising sun to the east, and their right-hand side would have the south, and everybody favouring the right-hand side to the left-hand side. The right-hand side was clearly more important. The south was more important. The south was at the top of the map. In Europe, often in the Middle Ages, maps were sort of swiveled around on their side, and the east was put on the top. And the reason for that was because the east was, from Europe, the direction of paradise and Jerusalem and so forth, and the most important place. So it was only relatively recently, when the age of discoveries, I mean, Columbus and his pals all sort of started using these things for actual navigation as opposed to prettifying their castles. And then the north, as we know it, is pretty much rules supreme now, yes. But it was happenstance, in a sense.
How did Viagra come to form a potent part of the CIA's strategy in Afghanistan?
You choose your words well. Viagra has been used as an inducement to tribal chieftains to effectively give useful intelligence on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and so forth. What the CIA tried first was giving them SUVs and loads of dollar bills. Of course, the tribal chieftains, not being very sensible, would drive around in their SUVs and flash their dollar bills and promptly get killed because it was obvious they weren't getting that from growing, cotton or whatever it is that they grow. So they discovered that actually if they gave them Viagra, it was pretty much confined to the bedroom, and the Taliban weren't too well informed about what was going on in the chief's bedroom. So they kept their chiefs alive.
And happy.
And happy, exactly. So a win for everybody.
There's a lot of stuff about France here, and I can't go into all of it, all that fascinating stuff about the decimal calendar that was created when the French were also mm-hmm. creating the metric system. Mm-hmm. But one thing seems too good to be true. Did the French really develop military camouflage based on the work of the Cubists?
Yeah, it's a surprising fact. But it was actually an academic painter who came to the French and said, you can't go around. I mean, they had blue uniforms at the time. The Brits had bright red uniforms, making a target for yourselves. Why don't you use these techniques the Cubists have been doing, which is to break up what is the image and reassemble it in a different way. And as a happy side effect of doing that, that confuses the eye. So the French did commission various Cubist painters to produce these wonderful camouflage patterns. And because they were actually protecting themselves from aerial photography at the time, which was black and white, they had these really colourful, it must have been mind-blowing to see the battlefield of all these red, yellow, green patterns where they were hiding their guns or whatever underneath. And then it wasn't just the French, because then the Germans got wind of this and said, hey, we can do some of this too. And so the Germans decided to go one better, and they got the Cubist stuff, but then they also decided to have their own Kandinsky version and Monet version. And then the Brits, so everybody was getting there, it's one of the most colourful battlefield ever. The Brits said, well, we'll do our own thing. And for reasons which completely escaped me, decided to paint all their stuff in tartan, which I wouldn't have thought was a very good idea, but there you go.
Well, this will come as a surprise to Americans, not people in other countries, because I think we're the only ones who call them French fries. But the French had a law that banned the cultivation of potatoes for a while.
Yes, I think not just the French. Most of the Europeans had this idea that potatoes were basically animal feed, a bit like mangelwurzels and so forth. And it was only the Irish who actually ate the potatoes at that stage. And this guy Parmentier, he was actually a prisoner of war in Germany and was fed potatoes as his diet there, and decided they actually weren't bad, and actually found actually they're quite nutritious. So he made it his life's mission to actually promote the potato. And one of the reasons he did, which I think is quite amusing, is because nobody would eat this stuff, is he actually grew a plot of potatoes in Paris and then hired a load of security guards to sort of patrol around at night, so-called pretending to protect them. But at the same time, he'd said, whatever you do, let people steal the stuff. So everybody sort of kept going to his vegetable patch and taking these potatoes, thinking they must be super valuable, and trying them and actually finding that they were quite good. So yes, he was, he's obviously commemorating the Parmentier potatoes, but he brought the potatoes to the French.
Now, we don't have much time left, so I can't get into Frank Sinatra being arrested for seduction in New Jersey and the fact that the government of Portugal moved to Rio de Janeiro mm-hmm. during the Napoleonic Wars. I just want to talk about the dangers of doing this kind of thing. You reveal on your website that you broke into an East European communist leader's private mansion. I'm curious about that. You were also thrown into a Latin American prison cell.
Yeah, well, the first one was definitely the folly of youth and being hard up as a student. So this was this trip to Damascus. We traveled through Romania, and we came to the President Ciescu's private castle. There weren't such things as Lonely Planet guidebooks in those days, so all I had to go on was a sort of 20-year-old postcard which somebody had sent me from Romania saying, this is a wonderful, pretty castle. Me and my friend we thought we'll go and visit it. And being cheapskates, rather than, we saw this hut and a sort of drawbridge, rather than go across there and pay our, whatever it would be, $1 to get in, we saw a sewage pipe going across a great big sort of massive ditch thing that's about 20 foot deep, and we shimmied across this sewage pipe just to avoid the dollar fee, came out, took some photographs, and we would have got away with it except that I wanted one close-up. And at that point, I realised there were catwalks and there were guards and snipers and things, and suddenly sirens went off, guys come rushing from everywhere, pointing guns at us, and and we'd found we'd broken into the president's private mansion. Not a good thing to do in a communist dictatorship.
And it may be the reason that Ceausescu was deposed eventually.
I'm not sure about that. But and if you have time, the I have to say it was my British passport that saved me in Panama, being in jail in Panama. Because I was in Panama when the Reagan invaded and Noriega was, you know, bunged in the house and had all the music and what have you. And I think I was you know, a serious prospect for the firing squad, because they all believed I was an American, because I spoke English, and only Americans speak English. And I very frantically waved my British passport around and eventually managed them to get them to phone up HQ. And after a night in a rather unsavoury Panamanian jail, I was released and, of course, just hot-footed it straight to Costa Rica.
John Oldale, his book, A World of Curiosity, Surprising, Interesting, and Downright Unbelievable Facts from Every Nation on the Planet. It is published by Plume. Couldn't get to all of them, but it was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.